Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards.
Patrick Tarik Mellett's book, The Lie of 1652, is, to put it simply, a rewrite of South Africa's past. It's described as a radical critique of established pre-colonial and colonial history that explores what Africans lost and a plea for restoration and recognition. Not a book to undertake lightly, but motivated by his own lifelong experience and multi-layered identity, Mellett has rattled the cages of the archives and released the souls of the ancestors. I went to see him at his airy Bloberg home to find out where the story began and why he chose to write it now.
Firstly, I had the time now because I'm retired. I retired 5 years ago. And I had always wanted to pursue my heritage interests once I stopped working. But also it was the right time in the sense that a lot of these things in the book were with me years and years ago. And I didn't have the skill that has come with age or the education that has also come over time with age. I had, you know, left school very early and didn't really have much of a high school education, going out to work as a teen. And I had gone through all sorts of things. And if I had written this book at any other time, it would have been skewed in one way or another. The discipline of the writing, too, I wouldn't have had. Having done a master's degree, I now also knew research methodology, I knew the protocols that had to be followed and so on. And also just all the information was gathered over a lifetime. A lot of it was just hard research work following interest areas that I had. Others were serendipitous. It just happened or it came to me. I'll give you an example. When I spoke about the amount of shipping that came to the Cape before Jan van Riebeeck, I didn't know that for a long time. I had in my head what Richard Elphick had written, that there were 42 ships. And because I was working in the maritime arena, and I come from a family that has quite a few sailors, and so I, you know, now and again would go through maritime books. And of course, with maritime history, there is no other agenda but to talk about ships and to talk about the high seas and to talk about the technology of ships and the ports and so on. And lo and behold, like, I came across a one-liner in a general maritime book saying that, you know, there were all of these ships, over 1,000 ships that had come past the Cape. So I went and tracked down the source material, which was Gastra and Brain in the Netherlands, who had written, you know, a few volumes on maritime history. And from that, I got a record of which nationalities had dropped anchor in Table Bay, how many times, how many voyages there were, what was the outward-bound voyages, which is 1,071, what was the inward-bound, which was around 800. And then I looked at what those ships were carrying to the east and carrying from the east back. And, of course, you know, we have a whole range of products that come from East Asia, but also slaves. And then I also looked at this very interesting thing about maritime history, at least European maritime history, is that the Europeans weren't too good at this. And that, you know, we hear of Prince Henry the Navigator, who never ever set, you know, out on sail anywhere. And we find that, in fact, his navigators were Arabs. And as you start to look into it, you'll see that there's a long tradition of West Africans that served on navy ships and on merchant ships and on slaver ships. So you had Arabs and you had Africans and you had, there's again a maritime tradition of Indians who were known as the Lascars. And they served on vessels for 600 years, right through to the Second World War. There were Ethiopians that were on the vessels and there was Southeast Asians. So this visitations to the Cape involved huge numbers of officials and soldiers, because they were going to war in East India, going the one way, and slaves coming back the other way. The crews were this multi-ethnic crews, and it totally changes the paradigm. So rather than there being 42 vessels, you suddenly... So then you count how many people were actually, you know, and we're talking about over 120,000 if you look at the capacities of the ships. And that they had shore leave. You know, these people stopped here not to just stay on board the vessel, but very often the sick were moved to shore. Field hospitals were established. There were a number of other forts before Fort Tukhuduwa. There was at least two large shipwrecks, one in 1647, and the other one in 1644. I think 370 people on the one that stayed for 4 months, and 90 on the other that stayed for 9 months. Most stays were up to 3 weeks. So this must have had a huge impact on the people ashore. They couldn't have been these startled people that, yeah, you know, suddenly saw Europeans for the first time.
So this is one stream, quite literally, of what has gone into the book. But what was your core message that you wanted to put across? I can see this has been a lifetime's book that you've been building up. But what was the one thing that you wanted to say?
What I essentially wanted to address was what I would call the peopling of South Africa, the peopling of the Cape. Because this is where the distortion of the colonial era and the apartheid era in particular comes into being. People are seen very rigidly as races and as ethnicities. And I think, you know, my experience both from childhood and through adulthood was being born in a country where you had to, A, look a part, and B, be categorized as a part. And I found that being a human in South Africa was a lot more complex than what we were told it was in my childhood under apartheid, and what people were told it was about in my mother's time and my grandmother and my great-grandparents' time and so on. So my focus and interest here was born firstly out of the factor of our family's racial classification. And we were classified in one family. The whole classification thing really hit hard only at the end of the 50s, in the 60s. But the family had Indian, had coloured, and had white. But all poor. That was our common denominator. We were poor people. That was our identity before anything else. We were a class of people. We were low-born. We didn't have much education. I mean, I'm a first in my family in all this time to get an education in the modern era. Going back in time, I have one forebear who was a teacher long, long ago. But this whole issue of race classification and how it affected us, not just my family, but our neighborhood, because everybody was like us. We were all multi-ethnic in our makeup. So I had to go digging. Firstly, you know, I didn't know who my father was. So, you know, my journey, you know, doesn't start with a political understanding, an ideological or an academic understanding. It's a boy. Once there was a boy, and this boy didn't have a home, didn't have a father, and had a sometimes mother, and was pushed from pillar to post, and had to wrestle with, who am I? What's my identity in all of this? Just as a person, as a little person. And around me were other kids who were fostered or in, like we were in this children's asylum, and it was a very difficult and painful childhood. Can't even call it a childhood. It's almost like being born old into a scenario. So it starts from there. It starts from, who am I? Who do I belong to? Who belongs to me? Those kinds of questions. And I had one sort of epiphany sort of moment when I was about 8 years old. And my mum, who was working in a laundry shop in Nova Street, District 6, the little times that I was with her was precarious, because she had to go to work and she wasn't allowed to take a child with her to work. So she would hide me in the linen bags and that, and or give me to people around her if she knew the inspectors, the company inspectors for Nanusi Brothers, and there was a company called Lawson and Kirk. She worked for both of those. And one of the people she sent me to was this German nun at the Holy Cross in District 6. And here was this German lady who was a quiet and gentle soul. Many nuns aren't. Many nuns are horrific, actually. But this one was a very good, kindly woman. And she was helping my mum out. And she would take me, you know, on a Saturday and whatever, and I'd stay there. And then she had the statue of this black man who she would be kneeling down and praying and talking to and so on. And her name was Sister Martin, Mary Martin. And this saint was San Martino de Porres from Lima in Peru. Now, Martin, Marty, as I sort of started to call him after a while, Marty's mum was an African slave and his father was a Spanish soldier. And when you are born to an enslaved woman, you are also a slave. So that's how he started. So she taught me about slavery 400 or 500 years ago, and also taught me about her devotion to Martin and why and all of this. And for me to see in apartheid South Africa as a child, because you, as a child you're aware of all the stuff that's going on around you, a white lady talking respectfully, in fact venerating a black man, was quite a sight to behold. And then to be taught about slavery and to be taught, see, Martin was a mystic, so again he had certain powers and things. So for a child to be introduced to this black man who had powers and could help you, so she in a sense transferred her muse to me. So I got Marty as a muse for life.
And I think that actually she wasn't the only person who impacted your childhood. I think there was a certain, you describe him as a non-conformist Irish priest who was teaching you a wonderful story. Tell us about
him. No, that's Vinny, Vincent O'Gorman. Father Vinny was quite a character, as a lot of Irish priests were. But on my first morning in Standard 6, history, he was both a science and a history teacher. He walked in and he was just waving this book in his hand, which was a history textbook. And then suddenly he violently threw it in the dustbin and he says, "Rubbish! Propaganda! I'm not going to teach you this rubbish." And he went on then to explain that he was going to teach us history, and he was going to teach us that it was versions, and that we have to be aware that all that comes to our ears and sight is versions, and we need to distill these to find near enough what exactly happened. And then he said to us, "Now, as far as the exams are concerned, at the end of the year, 2 weeks before the exam, I'm going to give you sample papers, I'm going to tell you what they want you to say, and you can deal with it at that time. But until then, I'm going to teach you history." And I think that was also an indelible thing that gave me rudimentary tools of thinking, of challenging, of not just accepting. And I think Sister Martin and Father Vinny were indelible influences. They weren't the only ones. There was a pattern of these right through to Oliver Tambo and people of that stature over time. Professor Jack Simons, who was, you know, one of our political commissars in exile, a profound academic. So for me, this journey isn't just an intellectual exercise, it's very much an emotional one too. So Mary Martin told me that about slaves in South Africa as well for the first time. And in our family there was stories about my great grandmother on my mother's side, Francina Jagas, who was from the Cut River area in Eastern Cape. And we had to wrestle with these things. Now, as a child, I'm also watching my multicultural, multi-hued color family was suddenly being forced into little boxes. And my mom's mainstay was her sister, and she, with her brood, because my mom's sister was married to an Indian guy, and like their children, if you look at, well, they ceased now, if you look at Shirley had blonde hair, blue eyes, pale skin. Her brother, Herbert, who we call Busy, was Indian looking, completely. Dark hair, dark skin, but brother and sister. And when they went to the bioscope, at the door they would be stopped and one would be sent upstairs and the other one downstairs according to that early classifications in cinemas. So we were going through that. My mum also couldn't really look after me, so I had to be fostered, and I was in 4 foster families before the age of 7. So I was quite an inquiring kid. I had to look after myself much of the time, so I had to be more grown up than your average kid was at that time. and I saw things around me and had influences. And I remember being fostered by one family where the man was an Englishman. They had 8 children of their own. And I remember this man chastising one of his sons who used the K word and stressing to him that it's an African gentleman that you refer to and not by that word. And I'd never seen this man more angry. So there were things like this that I would pick up over time. And it started this inquiring mind. And initially the inquiring mind was simply to read. And I was an avid reader, and also to read newspapers and to see and analyze and ask questions as to what was happening. So the thing about forced removals and things about banning of people and banning of books and all of that impacted on me. I myself, as a teen worker, started 2 newspapers, both of which were banned, one after the other. So I had that experience already. The thing with life is, as soon as you walk against the grain, one thing after the next starts to happen to you, ultimately forced into exile and so on. But you take these indelible decisions in your life that mold your life. So, you know, I often say to people when they talk about identity, and they immediately start to look for some kind of ethnic or racial or religious or color identity. And identity is much more complex. Firstly, it's not identity, it's identities. We all collect identities from the day we're born until the day we die. We also discard identities from the day we're born till we die. And the strongest or greatest ingredient to identity is what you do with your life. It's about those decisions that happen along the way that creates different trajectories every time you say, should I do this or should I do that? You take race classification, looking the way I do and so on. When it came to the age of 16 and I presented myself to the Home Affairs to fill in the forms and that, and I put in their colored, and the woman said, no, you're not. So I said, how can you tell me? No, I'm not. I know who I am. This is my family. Well, no, you're not, she said. And then she says to me, I know what your game is. You're just trying to get out of going to the army, isn't it? So I said, well, you're damn right, I don't want to go to the army. I don't want to be, it's not my war, it's not my people, whatever, but it's not about that, you know. And we had this argument, and she said, well, you'll have to go and present yourself at the race classification board. And she wrote in the margin of the other, and she says, we can't go forward with this, but I'm going to go and tell the military about you. And so I was arrested. And they took me to this military camp, and they wanted to issue me with arms, and I just let it fall on the ground. I said, you can take the horse to the water, but you can't make it drink. That decision profoundly affects the next trajectory. So you have this decision. You know, it's like when I first started working. I worked for 10 rand a week for a 6-day week, 10 hours a day. And I could have just accepted that. But I ended up running away from that company, and they had to get the police to bring me back because I was an apprentice. And I had the decision to join a union or not. And once you do, it's a trajectory. Same with this thing. Once I made that stand, I was then arrested. And I was arrested by the security police. I was interrogated. The interrogation itself was an education to me because they called me things that I didn't even know what they were and made me go and think about what are those things and so on.
It's been such a journey. Your whole life you've been working towards this book one way or another.
Yes.
But key for the motivation was really finding out about your own identities, that the people who had created you, the people who came before you. And in the conclusion, you have listed them. I think there are 30 people. Who are all these people in your background, and how have you discovered them?
Okay, so look, having got to this place where I'm now committed to a path that is going against the society that I worked in, I'm saying to myself, okay, so what is your background? Who's this man that was your father? My mum told me my father died in a motor car accident, described the spot, everything, and it wasn't true. I then started to scratch, and the first part that I could scratch around was my mother's family, because I didn't know my father anything. I didn't have my mother's name, and I never had my father's name. My mother gave me the name of a previous husband she had divorced in the 1930s, 40s. And she had children by that man, and they were grown up. So my mum was in her 40s when she had me. So it was a bit difficult thing. And also my mother was one of those people, you can't ask a grown-up anything that's personal. It's none of your business. Eventually when I did find my father and these different siblings that I had, and I came with photographs, and my mother recognized, started talking about it. I said, but why didn't you tell me? She said, it's none of your business. So that thing of going and looking. So in this process, I eventually tracked that my great-grandfather, who lived for 100 years, from 1808 to 1908, had married a woman from the Cut River area, valley area in the Eastern Cape, and Cut River had a particular history. So I was able to learn about my grandmother through this history around why it was established as a buffer zone of Khoi and former slaves between the European settlers and the Xhosa, and how the community then split in their loyalties between the Xhosa on the one side and the Europeans on the other side, and how my great-grandfather was firstly a soldier who then was demobilized and married this woman from the Cut River and went to the Tembuland to farm and so on. So I learned that here were ancestors that rebelled against their time and left the colony to free Tembu territory. And I learned then that she had been born a slave just before the period of abolition. And that then connected me for the first time to enslavement. But my big hurdle was to find my father. And that was kind of put on ice to some degree because I was in exile and didn't have the wherewithal and the opportunity. When I returned from exile, and I then was, you know, head of public relations at Parliament, and I, you know, got one of my staff to help me, and we started to then track down possible relatives and do phone calls. Till eventually we hit on one who was a brother of my father. And through an interview with him, I then discovered my father was still alive, that there was at least one other sibling in Australia. Phoned that sibling, found out that there was eight, and that they were scattered around, and that they all had foster home experiences and all this kind of stuff. And then got my family name. And from my family name, through a lot of hard research, was able then to put together my father's side. My father had been born in District 6 in Cape Town, and his father before him from the Cunnilunt area here in the Western Cape, that's Barrydale area, little place called the Munzuk. And through then hardcore finding of birth certificates, baptism certificates, death certificates and so on, started to track. Ultimately, I come up with around 24, 25 enslaved persons and 5 Khoi persons, and then of course the 19 or so Europeans that intermarried within that group. I wasn't satisfied with just finding the dates and the names. I then tried to find out as much as I could about the personalities. And because the Dutch were such good record keepers, and because of some really great historians like Mansell Upham and Delia Robertson and people like that, I was able to put together the stories and create a continuum in time for 400 years to the present. And that in itself started to open up questions, cameo stories that contradicted the mainline story. And from that, a detective kind of mentality develops. All of this, by the way, is happening over 40 odd years. And now you start going after the stories that make up, and then you realize, but these are contradicting the stories we were told of the events of the time, that such and such and such and such could not have been if what I'm finding out now in the cameo stories is true. And that's where you get the whole contradiction coming out. In the first 50 to 100 years, there is a relatively multi-ethnic society developing. And certain events happen that take the trajectory into a racist paradigm, into race classification and all of this kind of thing. So you then start to say, okay, well, let me do the history of race classification and see how, and so I start to look at all the census from the less formal ones in the 16 and 1700s through to the formal ones in the mid 1800s and then the 1900s, which then takes you on to the Population Registration Act and brings you back to my family, what happened to them, how they were split up, and how from this Francina and William in Tembuland, six children are born, and half of them marry white and half of them don't. So you have the six colored children who then, again, marrying across color lines right up until the generation today. You know, our children's generation and married Nama, Krikwa, Xhosa, Indian, Chinese, Thai, coloured, European, all in one family.
And your own family, I mean, your own forebears. There's a list of these 30 people who are your forebears, which include Krutua, Katerina van Malabar, somebody from Van Bengal. You are a world citizen.
So when I look at my family tree and ancestors, it also resonates with a spiritual dimension, which, you know, as a kid growing up as well, besides not knowing who you were and so on, because I was influenced by so many different influences, I had different religious influences. So Catholicism, Islam, over time Buddhism, also traditional African belief systems, African and Asian belief systems. So, you know, today in my old age, I would say I have a syncretic faith. It's not one or the other of these. It's a mix. Just as I am a mix of various ethnicities and so on, so is my faith a mix. And if you can imagine, under slavery, they didn't actually go and Christianize slaves. A few did become Christians, but it wasn't in the interest of masters to Christianize, because then they would have to give freedom at a certain point in time based on the theology of in Christ all people are free. So they didn't till the end of slavery. Others became Muslim in an underground faith. But people also brought Buddhist and Catholic beliefs as faiths across. They brought what is called Dukun. In the Americas, they call it Vudun, Voodoo, or Santeria. I have that kind of faith, which is one which is based on ancestors and saints. And this is the common thread in all of these faiths. So talking to ancestors, venerating ancestors, learning from ancestors, hence you have to know their stories and not just their names and so on, became very important to me. So when I go back and I look at the blend, firstly, I have five Khoi ancestors from two different family lines. So the one is the Achimau Krotoa family line, Krotoa being a ninth great grandmother when I do my descent. The other is a family from the Tulbagh area, which was then called Rodezand, and these were the two Voortman sisters. Their mother, in her baptism and all record, she's got a European name, but in brackets, Kaiki Hottentotten. And they are a mix of slave, Khoi, and German. Then, on the purely slave side, I have ancestors from Angola, from Kerala, India, from West Bengal, from what is called the Golden Triangle. It's where Myanmar, Laos, and Thailand mix around the Mekong River, and then China is just a little way away. You know, when we talk about these geographical boundaries, these are modern boundaries. In those days, that was just the Golden Triangle around these two rivers that flow. Then from Sulawesi, which is one of the biggest islands of the Indonesian archipelago that is part of Indonesia. And the peoples of Sulawesi, there's at least five different tribes, but also a lot of people came to Sulawesi from the Solomon Islands. And the Solomon Islands is outside of the Indonesian archipelago. And it is an island grouping that is fast being overtaken by the sea. So the one island, Ontong Island, and you'll find there are many Ontongs in South Africa. In fact, the Ontong surname is predominantly in South Africa, in Sulawesi, in Philippines, and then in Ontong Island itself. From there, Ethiopia, Madagascar, and then what we call Creole slaves. You know, Creole is the third generation born from first generation slaves, so locally born slaves. So that makes up 24. So it's quite a kaleidoscope of African and Asian slaves. There was about 78,000 first generation slaves that were brought to South Africa from this array of places. And they break down roughly into around 48,000 from Africa and Madagascar, and then 17,500 from India, West Bengal, Sri Lanka, and then another 13,200 from that huge ASEAN area of Southeast Asia. So I have these roots, these amazing roots, which have become very much a part of my life over time. As I discovered them, I would try and find out as much as possible about those regions. I actually tracked 195 roots of origin, places, and peoples that make up what people call colored identity, what I call Khamisa African identity. So that's very, very much a part of my life. So the boy, we didn't know who he was, became the man who knew so much about who he is and where he comes from. And these are all just ingredients which, along with my life experience and the choices that I made to resist, I talk of it as being taking the resistance road, and from it I got a liberated life. So even though when I look around at South Africa that I went to fight for liberation, and I'm very disappointed at many levels about what we've not been able to achieve, at a personal level, there's been a great achievement, because as a person inside myself, South Africa has still got to get there in many respects. So that liberated, that resistance road and following the liberation struggle has delivered to me as a person a personal inner liberation from being that lost child to this man who knows where he comes from. Knowing where you come from is extremely important to be able to navigate your present and to know where you're going, your future. And that's why a lot of my life now as a retired person is orientated towards youth and to answering those kinds of questions. So the book, to some degree, is a legacy project that I'm leaving for future generations. But I'm also developing a museum called the Khamisa Museum, which will be a more tangible experience than even the book, about the same subject matter. And it's going to be based at the castle. And why there? That's where thousands of our children every year are brought from schools by their teachers. And all they see is this colonial old place. What we're going to do is to create a series of boutique museums, starting with the Khamisa Museum at the castle. So when the children come there, they're going to go away with knowing a little bit more about who they are and where they come from. I call it restorative memory. We talk a lot about restorative justice and restitution, but that's going to be very skewed if you don't first have restorative memory. And I give the example, for instance, with District 6. District 6 had 70,000 inhabitants, and they were forcibly removed. The vast majority of those inhabitants were tenants. They were renters of property. They might have paid that rent, that their property's value, over and over again over the years as rent, but they didn't hold title deed. So when they talked about restorative justice for District 6, the first thing they said is, and it's been the only thing, that you, if you can find your title deed, you can get your property restored to you. But that's not restorative justice, because it's a skewed version of restorative memory. Restorative memory says the vast majority of people had no title deed. They were renting. And only a tiny fraction would have had that. In fact, external European landlords often owned those properties. But in terms of justice, surely the ownership was the people that paid so much rent over such a long period of time. But they cannot claim anything, and their descendants cannot claim anything. So are we really getting restorative justice in the District 6 restitution program? No, if you take restorative memory into consideration. We talk about the land question as a whole, which is also what comes out of that book. But generally speaking, those people who were the first to lose their lands over a 227-year period don't come into anything because the land restitution is from 1913 onwards. So again, restorative memory is not guiding restorative justice. The problem, for instance, for me, restorative justice on the Cape Flats would be how do we house those many, many thousands of backyard dwellers? How do we house those many, many people in shanty towns? This has got nothing to do with title deeds. It's got everything to do with restoring memory that says, how did those people become into that position? And when you unpack that, you're going to get a whole lot of skeletons coming out of the cupboard. Now, the restorative justice cannot be based on one person proving ownership of a piece of land against another person taking that piece of land. You've got to say that collectively, because this is now the descendants, the 70,000 are now probably 800,000. How do you bring restorative justice to 800,000 on that formula? You surely have to have another formula to really do that. And you can only have that formula if you actually know the history first. You know, what I'm trying to say is all this history is contemporary. It's about how do we wrestle with contemporary problems. We take the problem of gratuitous violence. We take the problem of substance abuse. Just take those two. Now you track it. You track back in 1658, 402 young children, child slaves, are deposited here at the Cape. Van Riebeeck's party is only about 90, so they're outnumbered 3-1. What does Van Riebeeck do? His major preoccupation is to pacify these children. So he gives them alcohol and tobacco rations. And we then progress from there to the dorp system on the farms, to the system of we've got now tick and alcohol problems today. Gratuitous violence. We had 150 years of crucifixions in Cape Town, of garroting, of burning at the stake, of really forms of judicial violence that was public display as entertainment. You had the genocide where 300, 500, 800 San people at a time executed and women's breasts cut off and made tobacco pouches with. In the same way that you have alcohol fetal syndrome, you also have something that I call generationally transmitted trauma, where it visits over and over and over again. So if we're going to solve gender-based violence today, if we're going to solve the gratuitous gang violence that we see, the substance abuse and so on, we've got to restore the memory as to how we got here so that we can find a way to navigate the present and the future. So this is not just about the past, it's about the present and how we go on from here.
And many, many questions. So my last question for you was clearly a process writing this book, a lifelong process writing this book, with many people who were part of it. Were your ancestors, were the spirit of your ancestors with you as you were writing?
Oh, I believe so, absolutely. You know, people often say to me, I had one partner at one stage where she saw me and she said, "You're busy with those dead people again." You know? And I don't know, there was a movie, I don't know what it was called now, something, Sixth Sense or something like this, where there's this little boy and he keeps saying, "I see dead people, I see dead." Now, it's like that with me. It's not in the macabre sense, but I walk around town anywhere that I literally see the past. You know those movies where you see the present and then it goes into sepia to... It's like that with me in real life. I'm constantly in and out of the lives of forebears. And so they're very much alive to me. And I'm going to be a forebear to some people in the future too. We all are. It's absolutely part of me. It's a spirituality. It's a place where spirituality and science meet. Some people might think of it as mumbo jumbo. You know, I come from a Marxist background in terms of paradigm of thinking, scientific socialism, etc. and that. But, you know, I've also learned in my whole life with ideology and that, it's not as clear-cut as everybody would like it to be. And there is, for me, there is a spiritual dimension, and it's the ancestral dimension. It's based on real people who left something behind. And they also lived through adversities and rose above that. So if people ask me who you are and what you are, the first thing I say is, I'm born of a people who rose above adversity. Secondly, I will start to talk about myself as being Khamisa, African, Southern African, African, and internationalist. Immediately, you see, I'm not saying I'm one thing. It's all of these together. And the ancestral continuum is the constant. It's where we all belong. We have come from dust, and we'll go back to dust in terms of our physical. Within the world, there's a kind of great big soul that all the experiences of the past is within that, and we all tap into it all the time. Nobody can say they stand outside of it. You know, it's an intangible, but it's a very explainable intangible. For me, that spirituality is, I am now contributing to that great big thing, and the next generation will contribute to that. To deny that there is that great big idea, thought, etc., we all build on it. We switch on TVs and cell phones and all of that today. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. It popped out of innovation, use of the mind, creativity of people who went before us. So every time we switch on the light, Tesla and Edison are at work. In that sense, they are living forever.
Well, you have switched on the light. You will have switched on the light for many, many people with your book. Patrick Tariq Millet, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think if anybody would like to know a whole lot more of where that came from, The Lie of the Land, 1652, it's published by Tafelberg. Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Great that you were able to spend a bit of time with me scratching up what it is that makes me tick and what makes that work tick. Sure, thank you.